Welcome back to the Dealmakers Podcast Show with serial entrepreneur Alejandro Cremades, best-selling author of The Art of Startup Fundraising and co-founder at Panthera Advisors. In this podcast, we ask our guests about their successful acquisitions and financing rounds.
Alrighty, hello everyone and welcome to the Dealmaker Show. So today we have a really fantastic founder. You know, we're going to be talking about all the good stuff that we like to hear, like the building, scaling, financing, you name it. We're going to have some good stories there on the fundraising, you know, how they thought about term sheets, Y Combinator, and then also culture. You know, there's some really interesting components on the way that they think about culture, how they gotten influenced, you know, that culture, you know, by also, you know, meeting perhaps, you know, like really reputable leaders out there. But again, you know, super inspiring conversation ahead. And without further ado, let's welcome our guest today, Eyal Yagev. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So originally born in Israel, give us a walk through memory lane. How was life growing up for you?
It was good. Yes, I was born in Israel, grew up there. Actually, moved to the Silicon Valley for a couple of years for my dad's job back in the early 90s, which was a fun part. And then came back to Israel. Eventually, I went to the IDF, like everybody in Israel has to. End up going to Unit 8200, which is essentially the Israeli NSA. And that's essentially where I ran into, you know, security and enterprise security for the first time. And I sort of fell in love with the topic. And once I left and kind of spent all my career in the private sector, I stayed in enterprise security.
And what was it about enterprise security that got you hooked?
It was just a super interesting topic. It's funny, I don't know if I'll give you a really good example on why, you know, to some extent, why I loved it and why you see so many people coming out of Israel and creating these amazing cybersecurity companies. I don't know if you ever kind of thought about why Israel became such a huge security hub. But essentially, it's kind of like when you look at, you know, the soccer teams of the U.S., right? The U.S. has some amazing athletes, probably some of the best athletes in the world. But their soccer team is always not, you know, not the top, you know, and never gets to kind of the top. And the reason is, if you're a very, very good athlete in the U.S., you're probably not going to go into soccer, right? You're going to go into football, American football. You're going to go into, you know, baseball. You're going to go into basketball, but you're not going to go into soccer. It's sort of the same thing that's happening. Basically, what happens in Israel is that you have to go into military service. And if you're the kind of person who can be potentially phenomenal in the tech scene, you're probably going to go into a unit like 8200 or similar units. And what they're going to focus on there is essentially security, right? That's what they're focused on. So things around cybersecurity and enterprise security. And that's why you see people kind of coming out and they kind of fell in love with the topic, because it's obviously, it's super interesting. It's super deep. It's technical. There's a lot of exciting things you can do there. And people come out already in love with that topic. And that's why you see so many startups in that space coming out of Israel.
So then let's talk about you know, how it was for you, because, you know, as you were saying, you know, you were in the NSA equivalent. I'm sure that, you know, the army there in Israel, you know, it gives you a lot of discipline and I guess, how was that experience for you of like having to do the army years, and how do you think that shaped you up?
Yeah, so it definitely does, right? You kind of have to grow up relatively quickly, right? If you're, you know, 18 and you're, you know, in Europe or the US, you go to college and, you know, it's sort of, again, I haven't gone to an American, you know, kind of four-year college, obviously. I went to university in Israel. But I'm guessing it's basically like the continuation of high school in many extents. And you kind of see all the parties and all of that. And you go into the military and obviously it's a very, very different environment. And you essentially have to grow up very, very quickly. And again, it's not like 8200. It's to some extent, in many aspects, it's like a tech company. In the sense that, again, you kind of work, you know, you there's all, you know, developers or, you know, these types of things that you get engaged with. But it is, again, the commitment levels are very different, right? Because it matters of life and death, right? It's national security. So people, and it is a military type environment. So you tend to kind of grow up very, very fast. And to some, again, for me, it was phenomenal. There's a lot of other people that I've seen around me. It was phenomenal for them. And to me, the best thing out of it was you just the network that you build there, that I've met some of the best and the smartest people that I've met in my life in that environment, people that I've stayed in touch with throughout this day. And if I kind of look back now and who are I know some of the most successful entrepreneurs, some of the most successful investors, some of the kind of, you know, leading people, you know, in Israeli society are people that I, you know, got to meet there, because again, it's just a phenomenal group of people.
Now, in your case, you were involved in several companies, you know, some that were acquired, others that they IPO'd. What were some of the patterns or the traits that you saw on those companies that the positive ingredients that would allow for the company to thrive and to succeed?
Yeah. So I guess before I kind of go into kind of deeper, I think one thing is luck, right? Right? Luck has a lot to do with this. And I think, you know, to some extent, you've seen some phenomenal companies not being successful. And again, they've done everything right, but again, timing wasn't right or something else happened. So again, I want to preface by saying this, but I think to me, the one ingredient that is more important than anything else is company culture. And that's what's essentially, you know, separating companies that are going to be very, very successful than companies that are, you know, sort of becoming less successful. And there's a lot of things that go into the kind of the company culture, but essentially, again, the working together, you know, working in a way that, you know, is collaborative, you know, wanting to succeed, you know, willing to kind of to do whatever it takes. So there's a lot of things that kind of go into the culture of companies that are eventually very, very successful versus companies that don't. And to some extent, obviously, every company has its own kind of unique culture. And sometimes you need a specific culture, you know, to kind of win a market, right? I think Uber is a great example of a company that I think, you know, wouldn't necessarily have a culture that's a good fit for me, or at least the kind of the early days of Uber, because Uber was a lot about kind of going and fighting, you know, territory by territory, fighting the regulators and, you know, going against, you know, everybody, which again requires a very specific type of culture that was great for them, but again, wouldn't be right for other companies.
So I know that you, for example, you even met Eric, the co-founder and CEO of Zoom. What did you learn about perhaps the way that he was thinking about culture?
Yeah, I got a chance to kind of meet him in sort of a small group founder setting. We talked, and one of the things he loves talking about and he talked about was culture, and it really resonated with me. This was kind of very early on in my journey. And again, I kind of went back to thinking, and I spent a lot of time in a lot of companies, you know, over the years. So I kind of saw what I liked and what I didn't like about specific cultures and what, you know, specific behaviors or, you know, culture kind of leads to specific behaviors that are detrimental or, you know, helpful to the success of the company. What I loved about the way he talked about this, which I adopted for, you know, for my company, is he said he has kind of one word for culture. And I kind of always had the notion, I've seen this in many cases, that you can put whatever you want on the wall, right? You can have these sort of 10, you know, things you put on the wall. None of that really matters, right? It's not about what you say, it's about what you do. And it's the thousands of decisions that you make every day that kind of make up the culture of the company. It comes from the leadership, right? Everybody kind of looks at what the CEO does. And everybody looks at what the executive team is doing. And it's not what about you say, it's about what you do. And he said, and he kind of shared that same sentiment. He said, that's why he has only one word. And for him, that word was care. He said, you know, we care about our employees. We care about our, you know, we care about our customers. We care about our partners. And I thought that was just a beautiful way to kind of think about this and to phrase it. And I borrowed that same thing for the culture, you know, for Anjuna, just because this is, again, I think this is the right way to. And I'll give you one very, very good example of this. I've worked at companies where if something goes wrong, you know, whoever the manager is or the CEO is looking for, you know, who should be blamed for this. And I think that's horrible for the culture of the company. And it doesn't get you the results that you want, right? You find somebody to blame, you kind of made them feel bad about it. But, you know, and I think the right conversation to have is when something bad happens, you know, you want to figure out, okay, how do we fix this? And then how do we learn, you know, going forward to make sure we don't repeat that same mistake? I think that's a much, much healthier approach than, you know, finding who to blame, which again, doesn't really, maybe make somebody feel better in that second, but it's not going to help the company.
Let's talk about one thing here, because you basically decided to shift gears, you know, when you attended your master's in Berkeley. And then from there, you know, you kind of like went into doing different roles, Lookout, OpenDNS, I mean, Safe Breach. I mean, you did like a bunch of those different companies, but I'm sure that you had like that business thing, you know, in you. At what point does that business in you start to form the shape of, hey, you know, maybe it's time for me to start my own company?
Yeah, no, great question. So to some extent, I always kind of knew that I want to be an entrepreneur at some point. Again, to me, it was both kind of the right timing in my career, as well as having kind of the right idea that I'm extremely excited about. And, you know, I thought would be extremely sort of revolutionary. And something that for me, if I wanted to start a company, I wanted to do something that's going to shift. You know, it wasn't about kind of doing some, you know, feature type applications, got to get acquired quickly. And which again, it might have a nice financial outcome, but I wanted to work on things that are actually going to make a difference. And to some extent, all the experience that I've had helped me kind of shape me into who I am today and, you know, kind of prepared me for starting the company, both in terms of just, you know, learning the business, learning, you know, how the market works, learning how to build a company and kind of seeing it, you know, when other people are doing it, as well as, again, seeing cultures that I liked or didn't like that helped kind of my thinking about my culture. What eventually happened is I was you know, VP of product of a company called SafeBreach, again, a really great company, and I enjoyed my time there. But then who ended up being my co-founder, Ron, who I've known for, you know, about 25 years, he was also in the Israeli intelligence community. He was just finishing up his PhD at Stanford. And he came up with this phenomenal idea. He ran into a technology called confidential computing that he was super excited about. And he came to me to talk to me about this. And I just got super excited by what this means for the market. And the reason I got excited was, I don't know how much you know about enterprise security, but essentially the best security solutions were always business enablers. Right? And what I mean by that is that something you see it in the physical world as well, right? If you didn't trust your bank with your money, just banks wouldn't exist, right? You need that security and trust to be able to build businesses on top of it. If you don't have that security and trust, you can't really build things on top of. And obviously we see this in the digital world as well, right? The firewall, which I'm sure you're familiar with, is a very, very good example. The reason why the firewall became so successful wasn't the security aspect, it was because of what it enabled. And what it essentially enabled was it enabled organizations to connect to the internet for the first time. Because I'm sort of still old enough to remember that all these, you know, neural networks were completely disconnected to one another and nobody wanted to connect to the internet because of the security risk. And the firewall is what opened it up and created just a huge amount of value. And when Jan came to me with, you know, with the idea of confidential computing, to me it was very clear this was the next big, you know, big enabler, business enabler when it comes to security. So it was sort of exciting enough for me to kind of to take the plunge and go start Anjuna.
So then let's talk about Anjuna. You know, how essentially, you know, you guys got to the point of getting started and what those early days, you know, look like.
Essentially, the first thing that I've done, you know, is again, I was excited about this, but I wanted to see that, again, I'm basically a product manager at heart, right? I kind of grew up, you know, doing product, and that was most of my career. And I basically wanted to go talk to as many customers or potential customers as possible to go see if this was a good idea. And I've spent, you know, a few months kind of doing that, getting just a ton of feedback and seeing, you know, this is as exciting as I think it is. Then what we've done is we basically started, you know, talking to investors, mostly here in Silicon Valley. And we're sort of lucky enough to have gotten a term sheet relatively quickly from just a phenomenal VC firm. And again, we actually end up with a few term sheets. One of them was just a really phenomenal one that we loved working with. The other interesting thing that happened was around the same time is we applied to YC and we got the call that we got into YC. So essentially at that point, we had kind of the dilemma, right? We had the term sheet from, you know, a $3 million seed round, and we had, you know, the acceptance to YC. And it's funny because we talked to kind of both of them, and YC basically told us, you know, why take, you know, come do YC and go raise money after YC. If you're raising now, it's going to be even easier after you go through YC. And the investors told us, you know, why do, like, you already have the term sheet, why you need YC, or have the, you know, the investment, go, you know, take that investment and go build a company. And I kind of understand both point of views, but we ended up eventually doing both. Extremely happy how things turned out, because YC is one of the best, you know, entrepreneurship schools out there. And they've taught us a lot about, you know, how to build a company and how to fundraise. And it was just a phenomenal, phenomenal experience. And obviously the YC network is great. But those investors turned out to be just phenomenal investors to work with. And they just helped us tremendously as we kind of built the company and still are doing so.
Hey, guys. So pardon the interruption here. So I got to tell you that, you know, for those of you that are either looking to raise money or you're looking to get your company acquired, you don't have to be alone. You know, there's a lot of psychology that needs to be blended with strategy, with methodology, with process. And it's very hard, and already doing your business alone is super, super difficult. So I remember, you know, back then when I was an entrepreneur, I kept really experiencing the challenge of either knowing or finding the right type of access to the right type of investors, or really understanding what was the right type of guidance, you know, that would carry me through the process, whether it was with seeking money or with going through the acquisition. So that gap that I found being an entrepreneur is ultimately what pushed me later on, when I met my co-founder at Pantera, Mike Severson, to really put together an advisory firm where we are guiding entrepreneurs and founding teams through the capital raising efforts, whether you are at a seed stage or at a Series A stage, or if you are going through the process of an acquisition and you are in small to mid-cap type of cycle. So Again, you know, we would help you from guiding you and supporting you from A to C all the way to the end as an extension of your team. And there's no reason for you to do this alone. So with that being said, if you would like to find out more, feel free to send me an email at alejandro@panteraadvisors.com. And we would love to take a look at helping you out.
What was the before and after of Y Combinator? In the sense of what kind of experience of impact did you guys get from attending the accelerator?
I think one of the biggest benefits you get from YC, as they said, is raising, you know, is being able to cut out to come out and raise a seed round. To some extent, in that sense, they were right. And when I talk to people that are applying to YC or have gone into YC and are thinking, you know, should we go? A lot of what I'm saying is if you haven't raised a seed round, going into YC is going to, one, make it a lot easier, and also is going to make the valuation much, much higher just because of the brand name, but also because of how YC kind of make sure you do the right things to be able to you know, build a great company. So they kind of focus you on what's important and kind of defocus you from what's not important. So I think it's a really great thing to do. And to some extent, again, for us, we already raised the seed round, but it was exactly that. It's kind of focusing us on, okay, this is the right things to focus on as a company. This is what matters. This is what does, you know, matters less or doesn't matter now. I'll give you one example that I thought was great. So Drew Houston, the you know, CEO, co-founder of Dropbox, I was one of the speakers. They're obviously a very famous YC company, and he came to talk to us during the batch. And one of the things he said, which I think was absolutely right, he said, like, at your stage, just don't focus on competitors. Like, it just doesn't matter. If you're a seed stage company, go find product market fit. Just don't focus. Don't even think twice about what your competitors are doing. He said, you know, when we're, you know, a much, much bigger company, and I think it was Steve Jobs at one of the Apple conferences came in and said, you know, we're going to build something that's going to kill, you know, Dropbox. But at that point, yeah, worry about competition, but not as a seed stage company. And I think it's sort of tips like that on what to focus on versus what not to focus on, what not to spend your time on. Again, talk about, you know, PR at early stage. He said that you don't need a PR agency. You don't need to focus on PR at early stage because it's not going to matter. You're not going to get customers through PR. And what you need to focus on at this stage is getting as many customers as you want, right? It's, you know, another great piece of advice that I loved was that it's better to have, you know, 10 customers that love you than 1,000 customers that like you. And once you have 10 customers that love you, you can go expand from there. There's all these sort of, you know, some of those, again, stayed with me, as you can see, for years later. And it was just phenomenal, just a phenomenal startup school in terms of what is really important and what's not important.
So for the people that are listening to get it, what ended up being the business model of Anjuna? How do you guys make money?
Yeah, so we're essentially a very classic enterprise, you know, enterprise sales company. We tend to sell to, you know, we're essentially a B2B with a classic, you know, enterprise sales motion. The again, security is weird in the sense that the early adopters of security, and it's true for us as well, tend to be kind of the large regulated industries. So, you know, financial services, you know, banking, payments, you know, insurance companies, et cetera, healthcare, less so the providers, but more the insurers and pharma. You know, at least for us, government has been a customer as well, even though they're obviously extremely kind of notably tough to get into. You know, oil and gas, manufacturing, all those kind of more regulated industries. And I think the reason why in security they tend to be the early adopters is that they're the ones with kind of the most burning need, right? If you're a kind of a large regulated industry, you know, if you're a bank, right, one is you're regulated, so you have to kind of do kind of the best you can in terms of security, but also you're a target, right? Banks are where the money is. And if you're targeted, then you have to think, you know, long and hard about security, and you always have to kind of be two steps ahead of the, you know, any attacker that might want to steal something. So that's why these organizations tend to be early adopters in security, even though they're not early adopters in other areas.
And how much capital have you guys raised to date? And what has been the journey of going through the capital raising rounds?
Yeah, so we raised about just over $60 million. So we've done the seed round. The A round was actually pretty great for us because the company that invested was Playground Global, just a phenomenal firm that invested that led our seed round, basically did that in order to be able to kind of be first in line to lead our A round. So when we were ready to go out for an A round, they just basically gave us a term sheet and we never actually went out to market. It was phenomenal. And then when we raised our Series B, again, I'm sure you talked a lot about kind of the process people kind of put together towards a fundraise. What we essentially ended up doing is we wanted to kind of get everything ready. So again, the investment deck, the data room, you know, the customer references, we kind of wanted to kind of have everything essentially ready for the fundraise. And again, I kind of talked to a lot of my, you know, advisors about, you know, the deck, about different types of, you know, how do we, you know, explain this. It was just, again, we've done that process. And then once we're ready, what I did was I ended up having a list of you know, investors that I thought could be a good fit for the round. And I kind of then ranked them, you know, basically, you know, one, two, or three, where one were kind of the top ones that I really wanted to work with. I thought they were the perfect fit. Two was kind of in the middle, and then three were kind of, and what I then did, I said, okay, I'll go out and kind of reach out to the investors in tier two. And based on the reaction I get, if, you know, there's a lot of excitement, things move forward, I'll kind of open it up to tier one. And if not, we can kind of decide if we want to open up to tier three, or maybe we're not ready and we kind of, you know, wait before we go out. And what ended up happening, I kind of opened up to tier two. I started having conversation. The SEO started going extremely well. But before even opening up to tier one, Insight reached out and they kind of pinged us. They kind of knew about us. They were pinging us every quarter. And this was somebody that was essentially an analyst. It wasn't, you know, one of the GPs. So, okay, this was like a low risk, you know, thing. I'll go talk to an analyst, even though I'm not ready to talk. Insight was one of our kind of tier one, you know, companies they wanted to work with. So, okay, I'll talk to an analyst, kind of update him and kind of tell them we're about to start a process. And everything just happened super quickly from there. Basically, I talked to him and I'd say within 5 days, I had a term sheet from Insight in my inbox. It was just phenomenal how quickly they were able to move. And just the, you know, the, I think they were probably researching the space. They kind of knew what they were doing. The partner that led the deal that ended up, you know, joining my board was extremely knowledgeable about this. Like I could kind of see it from the questions that he asked, that he's gone very, very deep. And yeah, just the process was just a pleasure for us.
So in that sense, you know, too, what have you also learned from now that you've gotten, you know, investors, you know, on board and you're dealing now with the corporate structure and running an effective, you know, board meeting and making sure that board members are adding value and really, you know, up to date with the issues that the company's experiencing so that they can, you know, help provide their strategic guidance to it. I mean, what have you learned on what typically works best to make sure that everyone at the board level is contributing?
Yeah. So I guess to me, board management is something that you have to kind of think about and plan. It's not something that you, if you don't think of, you know, it's one of the, again, it's kind of like culture in the sense that, you know, culture happens whether you think about it or not, right? But if you think about it and you kind of guide it, you're going to get much better results than if you don't. And it's the same with kind of board management, where there's going to be a relationship with the board is going to make decisions, but you need to kind of, if you want to do it in a way that's effective, you got to think about this. To me, one of the things I'm doing is with every one of my board members, I try to meet either every week or every other week. And part of it is just kind of making sure that they always know exactly what's happening in the company, the good and the bad, right? Some things are good, but, you know, like any startup, right? One of my early investors, I just saw him write a post about, and he's one of the super angel investors. He invested in probably hundreds of companies. So I've never met a successful founder who's happy about the state of the company. I think that's a very good, you know, I think that's very true. So again, there's a bunch of bad things that are happening. And to some extent, if you're the CEO, you know all the bad, right? Because any problem that's, you know, big enough not to be able to be solved up to you eventually ends up on your desk, right? So you kind of know all the bad. But I want to be extremely open with my investors, because then if you do need their help, if you do need their advice, then they're there for you. I think, you know, founders that kind of try to hide, you know, the bad from their board or from their investors end up in a much, much worse situation. And then having to, one, fix the situation without the help they could have had, but also it just erodes the trust that you have with your board members, your investors, which is just a horrible thing to do. So one is I talk to them every week or every other week to update them on what's happening. The other thing is, again, before every board meeting, I share the deck with them to get their feedback, you know, ahead of the board meeting. I obviously change things or add things based on their feedback. Again, I know that some people are kind of worried about kind of the board talking without you there. I have no issues with that. I have no issues with the board talking to my executive team, you know, directly. I think transparency, and again, it kind of goes to culture of the company to some extent. But I think transparency is just a very, very good thing to have. And I think it leads to good things. I don't think hiding problems, you know, helps.
100%. Now, obviously, all these people, you know, whether it's investors, customers, employees, I mean, they're all betting on a vision. So imagine when we're thinking about vision here and we're thinking about you going to sleep tonight, Ayal, and you wake up in a world where the vision of Anjuna is fully realized. What does that world look like?
Essentially, what we're doing is something called confidential computing that, as I mentioned, enables collaboration. I think eventually confidential computing will just become computing. And I think it's going to change the world in essentially two ways. One is when confidential computing is essentially computing, when everything is running this way, you can just run anything in anywhere, right? You can take any piece of code, any piece of data, and put it in any environment. It's all completely secure. And it just means you can run again, you can move anything to the public cloud. You can tell all the access, you know, machines that you have in your data center, you can rent them out to somebody to go run, you know, code on them, and they're going to be safe doing so, and you're going to be safe when they do so. So I think just the world of infrastructure just becomes almost like this layer on top of, you know, the data center and the cloud. You can just run anything anywhere. And I think it's going to go to the edge, right? You can, there's a lot of risk in running things at the edge. Again, think of like, I'll give you an example. Like Tesla is a great example, right? Every Tesla is essentially like a mini data center. There's a lot of computing power within your Tesla. But the problem is you don't have a lot of sensitive data there because you don't want somebody breaking into your car and stealing, you know, not just, you know, whatever you left in the car, but also your data there. It's just a very, very risky thing to do. But if you're running it in confidential computing, physical access means there's no access to the data. So you can just run whatever workloads you want, you know, in the car itself. And it's true for anything, sort of any, you know, edge device where you just, it's extremely risky to do it without, you know, that level of security. And if you have the right security, it just allows you to run the code anywhere. So I think that's one of the pieces of the vision. But the other one relates to security. It just simplifies security in a huge way. Because when you have this level of security, you know, a lot of the existing solutions, like, you know, even firewalls or, you know, antiviruses, their need to some extent, whether it goes away or becomes much, much lower. Because if you can run something on a machine, you know, let's say you're an unpatched, you know, no firewall, no antivirus, you know, connect to the internet, and you have, obviously you're going to have, you know, attackers with root access, you know, all over that machine running code. Even if they can do that, they can't get access to your data. That's just a whole new world of how you do things. So I think it's going to simplify security in a big, big way. Whereas today we never solved kind of the root cause of the problem. We're always kind of solving the perimeter of the problem. And this allows you to finally solve that root cause of the problem.
So we're talking about the future here. I want to talk about the past, but doing so with a lens of reflection. If I was to put you into a time machine and I bring you back in time, let's say I bring you back in time to that moment where, you know, around 2018, you were thinking about building something of your own right before you gave your notice. Okay. And then while you were working, let's say at SafeBridge, and you were able to have a chat with that younger self, with that younger Ayel, and give that younger self one piece of advice before launching a business. What would that be and why, given what you know now?
Oh, well, that's a really great question. I'd say the one piece of advice is it's going to be a lot harder and longer than you'd expect. But just, I guess my advice would be just enjoy the journey, which again, I'm still trying to kind of give myself this advice, you know, every day. It's funny, I'll tell you a story. I read this, somebody wrote on Twitter, which I thought was, you know, phenomenal. He basically said, you know, I had trouble, you know, sleeping at night. I couldn't sleep. And I tried all these things, you know, complete darkness. And I've tried, you know, not looking at screens for 2 hours before I sleep. And I tried, you know, melatonin, you know, it's all these things. What eventually worked for me is I stopped being the CEO of my startup. And it's basically that, right? It's just a very, very, it's a difficult thing to do. It's hard. You're, you know, invested, you're all in. And that's kind of the good and the bad of it, right? I always talk about, you know, being a startup founder is like having kids. And I don't know if you have kids or not. Yeah, so same. And when I had, you know, friend didn't have kids, asked me what it was like. I said it just makes everything a lot more extreme, right? The good is so much better. Like I've never, you know, thought I could love someone so much. And like it just makes, and like it's an amazing life experience to have kids. But like the bad is also so much worse than you could ever imagine. That, you know, you're waking up at 4 a.m. with a leaky diaper, right? Or one of your kids, you know, has some, you know, health issue. It's just such a difficult experience to go through. And you just couldn't even imagine those extremes before you had kids. And it's very, very much the same with startups. The extremes, you know, the good and the bad are, and I think unlike kids, the kind of the good is probably at startups, maybe like 2 or 3%, and the bad is the rest of it. But it's still an amazing, amazing experience.
That's incredible. So Ayel, for the people that are listening that would love to reach out and say hi, what is the best way for them to do so?
So the best way is either through my email. My email is my first name, so ayel@anjuna.io. So feel free to email me, happy to get back, or just reach out to me on LinkedIn.
Amazing. Well, easy enough. Well, Ayel, thank you so much for being on the Dealmaker Show today. It has been an honor to have you with us.
No, thank you. Thank you for having me.
If you like the show, make sure that you hit that subscribe button. If you could leave a review as well, that would be fantastic. And if you got any value, either from this episode or from the show itself, share it with a friend. Perhaps they also appreciate it. So also remember that if you need any help, whether it is with your fundraising efforts or with selling your business, you can reach me at alejandro@pantheraadvisors.com.
You've reached the end of another episode of the Dealmakers Podcast. For free resources and materials, head over to alejandrocremades.com. Thank you for listening, and see you at the next episode.